everyone. Welcome to our second talk in the series for the Hillary term on Iraq 20 years after the 2003 invasion. I am really delighted and honored to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Marcin Alshamri. It's wonderful to have someone who's done like very fresh, recent research on Iraq, has lived there a lot, has like a lot of like firsthand experience, really immersed is not the right word, like from there and like directly in touch through all these years. So we couldn't have been in better hands to learn more about Iraq post 2003. Marcin is a research fellow at the Middle East Initiative at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. She is also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and she is an incoming assistant professor of political science at Boston College. Should I add that she has also a PhD from MIT in political science as well. And her research examines the intersection of religion and politics in the Middle East, looking particularly at how the Shia religious establishment in Iraq has intervened in formal politics, in protests, and in peace building. So please join me in welcoming her and listening to her talk.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you so much for inviting me. Mariam, what a nice introduction. And I know Mariam from Boston, so it's so lovely to see her. And Eugene, thank you so much for the invitation. I am genuinely delighted to be here because I love talking about my research, but also I love any excuse to visit a beautiful campus, and this is definitely top five in the world. So for the definitive rankings, I will probably post on Twitter in maybe 5 years. So I wanted to say I have a script, but I'm notorious for going off script, and I think it's okay for this presentation because I'm going to be pulling a lot from my own experience having lived in Iraq in the last 2 years to give meat to this topic, which I think is very important, but is also part of my larger book project. So my book is about the role of clerics in protest in Iraq from about 1910 to 2020. So it covers a very long period of time, but I wanted to focus today on the most recent instance of protest, which is the 2019 protest movement, also called Tishreen in Iraq, and the role of clerics and the role of civil society in it, because I think there's a very fascinating intersection that you don't really get to see until you're on the ground in Iraq. And one of the things that I've been very grateful for during my time in Iraq is that a lot of my preconceived notions about how religion intersects with everyday life were very much challenged. And I think if I want you to come away with one thing during this presentation, is that oftentimes when you hear about a revolution or a protest movement or any kind of contentious political event, you often hear the narrative of very elite people who are presenting this protest movement. And it makes sense because the people who have access to media and have access to conveying a message in English are the upper middle class activists. And in Iraq's case, the medical doctors and engineers, not the political scientists and the economists or the sociologists and anthropologists. And for me, having received a lot of information when I was in the US about Iraq, despite doing a lot of field work in it, actually changed a lot when I moved back to the country and interacted with the reality of everyday life and how religion and activism and protest touch everyday life in ways that were not present to me when I was in the United States. And so one of these contradictions that's so important to discuss is that there seems to be the sense that protest movements happen in this very black and white ideology where they're anti-religion or secular, or they're, in Arabic they use the word civil, medani, because they don't want to say secular to not offend people who are conservative. But in reality, large segments of the population still identify with religion in very profound ways, and you can find the very same activists who say, we want a separation of religion and the state, we want a secular state, to be the very same people who on a Friday will listen to the sermon of a cleric talking about the protest movement. And to me, that was so puzzling and contradictory, and I really wanted to delve into why that was happening. And so today's talk, I will try to provide some answer to this and to elaborate a bit more on this very compelling relationship. So I have on the screen here just some various titles from both academic or policy work on the protest movement in 2019, as well as some journalism on the protest movement in 2019. And you can say this, like, you can see this rhetoric emerge of like, secular Shiism is on the rise in the Shia crescent. You know, I'm sure in Iran with the protests right now, we're hearing a lot about this too. It's very one-sided narrative, and it's just not one-sided as much as it's also conveying the superficial elements of a very, very deep movement. And in Iraq's case, there was a lot of this rhetoric without in-depth analysis of it. And I was really interested in uncovering this because I didn't think it really told the full story. Because while we got this kind of coverage, we also got something like this image I have from Al Jazeera, which says, Iraq protesters looked to Al-Sistani ahead of Friday sermon. And for those of you not familiar with him, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is the most important Shia religious cleric in Iraq. He has millions of followers within the country, followers within Iran, within the region, and across the globe. And you can see what is very striking about this image, and I don't know how well you can see it, is that his photo is right there on the building, which is called the Turkish Restaurant, which is really the focal point of the protest movement in Baghdad. This is where the protests were, where they were born, where they maintained their power, and where all the slogans emerged, and where all the demands were raised. And yet you have this photo of a cleric right there. And I really wanted to understand why you could have these two different rhetorics at the same time. And I delved into that during my time in Iraq by speaking both to clerics, but also more importantly to activists themselves and to the civil society leaders, as well as everyday protesters. Before, I didn't want to make this an overly academic lecture at all, so I'll just very briefly just talk about the different methods that I used to collect information, but I won't bore you with the details. Mainly it was a lot of interviews in the field with different people, but also some archival work that I've done over the years that I think is important to understand the full relationship between religion and the state. And some discourse analysis, and in the Q&A we can talk in more details about anything that's interesting to you, but just a very brief overview of that. So I wanted to start by first just discussing the key actors in this presentation. The first one being the Shia religious establishment in Iraq. I'll start by saying that Iraq is a very diverse country with a lot of religious actors, and so I very purposefully choose to study the Shia religious establishment because the greatest, the largest group in Iraq are the Shia of Iraq. And so the Shia religious establishment has very interesting level of authority over a large segment of the population. And what is more important to me is that until very recently, they've been largely absent in academic discourse, and there hasn't been many books about them. What you have instead is a lot of focus when it comes to the role of religion in the state on Al-Azhar in Egypt. Understandably, it's one of the most important religious institutions of Islam. And from the Shia side, everyone is of course preoccupied with Khomeini because he kind of upended everything we know about clerics and their role in politics. But he also inadvertently led to this belief that Iraqi clerics are quietists, they don't participate in politics, they don't participate in protests, they're quiet under authoritarianism and they're quiet under everything else, while you have this different school of thought that is much more involved and will create a theocratic state. And that's a very, you know, I was talking about black and white ideas in the beginning of this presentation, but that's another very black and white idea of what clerics do, and they operate on a much wider spectrum. So one of the reasons I focus on this institution is because I'm trying to fill in this gap of knowledge about the Hawza, which is the set of seminaries that operate in Iraq. There are seminaries, libraries, mosques, there are places where clerics teach. And you can see a photo up here of, you know, clerics in Najaf by a bunch of books. It's this kind of environment that I focus on. But to give you a bit of a firmer grasp on it, there's two concepts that I'd like you to keep in mind. The first one is the marji'iyya, which is really the upper echelons of religious leadership in Iraq. And by that I mean this system of religious training, the seminary that occurs within the Hausa is a very hierarchical one, but it's also very uninstitutionalized. It's not bureaucratized at all. It looks nothing like Oxford in the sense of, although I hear Oxford also isn't very institutionalized sometimes, but it's definitely less institutionalized than Oxford, I would say. But there isn't really, like, you don't come in and there's a professor who will guide you through and tell you, you know, this is a course you should take, and like by this point you should take this exam. I hear the exams here are very institutionalized, so there's nothing like that. And it's just a system in which you have to drive yourself to different classes, to different clerics. You have to build relationships with mentors, and you have to reach this level of knowledge where elite scholars are willing to say that you are well-versed enough, that you are knowledgeable enough, that you can infer laws, Islamic laws, on your own, and then you become what they call a mujtahid, someone who is able to infer Islamic knowledge on their own. And this process takes a very long time. I'd say, you know, 20 years to get through the very basic training at the three levels before you become in a position where you actually become an ayatollah or a grand ayatollah. And the key thing is that you really need followers to establish who you are. And within Shiaism, cleric has followers who are required to emulate them on religious matters. So it does give them a bit of authority, particularly on family issues and social issues. And they also are required, which is very important, to give a certain percentage of their disposable income as a religious tax of sorts. So clerics, when they reach very high levels in this institution, are able to finance a lot of their own endeavors. And most importantly, they're able to be very independent of the state. And this is what really makes this religious institution very unique, I would say. And this is what makes the marjaya, the religious leadership, the top echelons of this institution, very powerful. It's because they have their own resources and they have their own followers. So they have the ability to mobilize people to certain actions, to certain beliefs, and they have the ability to mobilize resources around different causes. And this is the reason that this institution was so preyed upon by former Iraqi regimes. So the Ba'athist era of Iraq, which I think everyone is very familiar with, is notorious for being a totalitarian state and an authoritarian state at other times, preying on large segments of the population. But one of the segments of the population that it preyed on most strongly was clerics, because it really did fear, particularly after the Iranian Revolution, that they would launch a movement similar to that in Iran and that they would take over the state because of their ability to control a large part of the population and their independence from the state. So in retaliation to that, the state decided to be very cautious of them and to control them to the extent possible. So one of the places that I visited during my research was the Ba'ath Archives in the Hoover Institute in Stanford. And for those of you less familiar with that story, it's basically all the documents of Saddam Hussein's government that were taken out of Iraq in 2003 and moved first to Washington and then to Stanford University in California for American academics to see, but for Iraqis to not see until 2019 or 2020 again. So there's a lot of ethical issues around these documents and their existence and where they are, but when you actually go and see them, you can actually see the inner workings of an entire regime. And one of the things that becomes very clear very quickly is that this regime was obsessed with clerics, particularly Shia clerics, but to not discriminate, it was obsessed with clerics across the board. It tried to keep Sunni clerics, for example, using the same sermons and the same language. It kept an eye on how clerics talked about Saddam Hussein in their sermons. I mean, it reached a level of pettiness where I could see that in some of the documents, they would check whether or not a cleric had praised and prayed for the president before they started their sermon. So it's a very tight level of regulation. The actual religious establishment itself had its numbers dwindling from the thousands to the hundreds during this period, from, I would say, 1980 to 2003. Very few international students came to this institution at this time, and the entire environment was very, very, very fearful of the state. And so in light of this, you can see that for a cleric, and I have this quotation, on the screen. When 2003 came, it was an entire reversal of fortune that I can't emphasize enough for them. They went from being individuals that were hunted down by the state, who were tortured and exiled, who were deported, whose family members were killed, to suddenly being in a very friendly relationship with the state. And not only that, sometimes the state would actually seek advice and seek legitimation from them. So one of the clerics I spoke to told me when I was speaking to him in 2018, so it's, you know, years since 2003, Iraq had seen the ISIS war, a lot of other difficulties, and there had seen several waves of protest. And the cleric said to me, we should be grateful for Iraq now. It's so much better than before, better than Saddam's era. The Ba'athists were criminals. And I think this is something that gets lost a lot when people look at Iraq today. They forget that for many of these clerics, who tend to be a lot older than the average Iraqi citizen, their formative years really were under Ba'athism. And they were so frightened by what happened under Saddam that anything in comparison was better for them than that. Despite the corruption of the current state, despite all these other grievances that the public expresses on a regular basis, they still have that point of comparison. But at the same time, it wasn't something that happened without, there was a price for the clerics to pay after 2003 and after this stronger relationship with the state. And their alliance, whether intended or whether it was accidental with the state, actually ended up depleting a lot of the good population's goodwill with the clerics in Iraq. And I actually remember a story of when I was in Iraq in 2003, I was just visiting, and at that time there was this big rhetoric going around about how, so I used to visit the city of Karbala, which would get a lot of pilgrims from Iran, and about how a lot of the Iranian pilgrims were warning the Iraqis, this was like the popular narrative in Karbala, of just wait a few years and you will hate these clerics like we hate them too. And so it was a sense that, like, once they become politicized, you won't like these people anymore. Once they're no longer oppressed, they won't resonate with you anymore. And so clerics in Iraq actually experienced a bit of this, despite being much less involved in politics than their Iranian counterparts. And it was largely because a lot of the Shia Islamist parties that did quite well in subsequent elections after 2003 and, 2005 and so on, they traced their roots to the clerical establishment. They would say, our founder is from the clerical establishment. We are Islamist parties. They would take photos with elite clerics, and they would try to market themselves as such. But because they performed so poorly when it came to public services, because the population saw them as being complicit in corruption, this reputation started to rub off on the clerical establishment as well. And they started suffering reputational costs. And so I have another quote here from a cleric whose name I didn't put up there, because I don't think he wanted others to know that he had said this, but he said to me, when some religious organizations entered political activity, meaning Islamist parties, this reflected badly on religion, and the street started to reject the turban, started to dislike the religious establishment. Why? Because they saw it as an authority that is responsible for 15 years of destruction and devastation that has befallen the country. This is how the street perceives the situation. So there's this perception of a reversal of fortune, strong ties to the state that they've never had before. At the same time, that came at the expense of losing the goodwill of the public. What made matters worse in a way was in 2014, when there was the ISIS incursion in Iraq, and there was this very well-known fatwa by Grand Ayatollah Sistani encouraging Iraqis to participate and to join security forces, which later led to the creation of the Popular Mobilization Forces, which were very popular in Iraq during the ISIS war. And, I have very distinct memory of being in Iraq in 2014 and 2015, and at that time they were considered absolute heroes in this cause and essential. But over time they became disliked by the population. They were seen as predatory, as non-state actors. And this also reflected badly on the religious establishment, because whether this fatwa actually led to the creation of paramilitary groups or whether it didn't, it still was attributed to the religious establishment's role in this war. And so I have this photo of a billboard of the various clerics who had died in this from the religious establishment in this effort. But this, you know, this kind of imagery is throughout Iraq, but the population's reaction to it has changed dramatically since the end of the war with ISIS. And this change in public opinion is something that you can see in a wide array of public opinion polls in Iraq. Some of them I trust more than others, but there's been enough public opinion work in Iraq that I do believe the findings reflect reality in this case. So this particular one is from the Arab Barometer, saying that in 2013, so before the war with ISIS, 19.5% of Iraqis surveyed preferred a non-religious party over a religious party. And by 2018, 40.6% preferred a non-religious party. So you see the population wanting non-religious parties more at this time. And this is also from the Arab Barometer, showing trust in Shia majority areas of Iraq. Barring Baghdad, most of these provinces are almost predominantly Shia. So you can see how the levels of trust in religious leaders have plummeted over the years. Of course, there's different definitions of which religious leaders we're talking about. There's also the question that I'll come back to in a second that I started this presentation with of, you know, we know, you know, this to be true. We know that this is a trend in Iraq. We know that there's a turn against religious role in politics. But at the same time, there's still a highly conservative society who, at the end of the day, was listening to the sermons during the protest movement. So there is still a big question mark about what exactly is happening in Iraq. There's a lot more public opinion data on Iraq that pretty much says the same thing. But in my interviews as well and in my time in Iraq, you can sense that this has happened and that opinions have plateaued more or less now. They're not on a decline, you know, until they plummet completely, but you can see that it is quite a distinction over the years. So this is all the context in terms of public opinion and how how everyone in Iraq feels, and where the clerics are in terms of their relationship with the state before the October protest movement, or the Tishreen movement, as it's called in Iraq. I mean, I don't even know how to begin to describe this movement because it's happened so recently that I have an advisor who always recommends never studying a protest movement until you're moved 15 years past it, so that you can reduce all the emotion and the energy around it. But this is quite recent. It happened in the fall of 2019 and the winter of 2020. It was cut short by the COVID pandemic. It is the largest anti-government protest movement in Iraq's post-2003 history. It destabilized the country for months on end, but it was limited to Baghdad and the Shia majority governorates in southern Iraq. There really weren't protests in Sunni areas or in Kurdish areas for various reasons that I'm happy to talk about. But what's really interesting is that in addition to them being predominantly Shia protests, I mean, this is a Shia population, they also had a very religious dynamic to them in the sense that anyone who's been to Iraq for pilgrimage, which I'm sure some of you have been, knows that there's this particular environment of almost a festival where people are cooking and providing free food and free housing, and there's these plays and these like cultural productions on the street. And this was something that was occurring during the protest movement. And I actually saw it again recently when Iraqis were hosting the Gulf Cup as well. It's, you know, every protest movement or every public event in Iraq takes on a religious character inadvertently, because this is how people know how to come together. It's how they operate in the public sphere. And so I remember watching this and seeing, like, you know, green flags representing Imam Hussein and Shiaism and just these productions that felt very strongly religious. At the same time, as you can see, you know, the demands on the Turkish restaurant, the building over here, or various demands being held by protesters of wanting to separate religion from the state and wanting no more Islamist parties, and just having these somewhat contradictory but not really contradictory demands, because this could also be just a cultural production. But in addition to the way that they express themselves, there is also the issue of everyone watching and waiting for the Friday sermons of Grand Ayatollah Sistani's representatives. There are two representatives and they took turns delivering sermons every Friday. And I can tell you that every single person in Iraq and every single Iraqi outside was waiting to hear what they were going to say. They were waiting for them to shepherd Iraq in a way through what was happening. And protesters were mainly interested in, will the clerics side with us or will they side with the state? Now, the protesters themselves and the activists were very much divided on what they wanted. So you have an entire group of people that are very revolutionary minded, that they would chant the typical things you would have seen in the Arab Spring, like Ashabiuri, Disbaldan, Nidam, which is, you know, entire regime change. And then you had very reformist people who had the inclination of having a new electoral law, or who wanted to the prime minister to resign, or something that worked within whatever institutions that Iraq already had. In my own research on this, I can say that the reformists were outnumbered by the revolutionaries, but the reformists were also much, much more articulate and were able to take control of creating these demands and writing them. And that's because a lot of the reformists came from Iraqi civil society, and Iraqi civil society took on the leadership role. I mean, keep in mind, this is a very big protest movement. Not everyone in here is a civil society activist who's dedicated their entire life. It's just a regular protest movement where different segments of society showed up. Some politicized, some being, you know, from the Sadr's movement, some being, you know, everyday students, people who felt compelled to join the mobilization because of family or other, or pressure, or just simply out of a sense of it being a historic moment. And so its demands were articulated by a different set of people as well. So when I spoke to the various protesters to tell them, you know, I'm very confused by your demands. On one hand, you say you want a secular state. You don't want any more Islamist parties. You don't want any more clerics involved in politics. And at the same time, why are you waiting for Grand Ayatollah Sistani to tell you what to do? And I was genuinely confused, and I spoke to them, and I also asked them, did you watch it? You know, did you actually care? So I have so many quotes from them, but I picked these two. One activist told me, even though I am secular and liberal, I still believe there's common ground between me and the religious establishment. And this speaks to a sort of pragmatism, pragmatic relationship that developed between elite activists and between the clerical establishment, where the activists realize that clerics are very powerful, and the clerics realize that their reputation needed rehabilitating, and that these were good allies for them. The other quote is from an activist in Basra. And she said, after October, it was very necessary that we followed the speeches of the religious establishment because it was the engine of movement for many people. Each speech was which supported the revolution was a source of strength for us. The sermons are important to us so that we can gain an audience. So they wanted the legitimation of the religious establishment to provide them with an audience and to provide them, in a way, also with a path forward. And what's really funny is some of the other activists, I remember distinctly speaking to a woman from Basra who at the end of the interview told me, by the way, I'm a Christian. And in a way, I'm not surprised knowing Iraq is, you know, there's different layers of leadership, but we went through an entire interview, and only in the end did she decide to tell me that. I was like, oh, that makes it a lot more interesting to hear that you've been listening and waiting. So the role of the religious establishment at this time was, I mean, it's really summarized by the slide, which says that the clerics called for calm. What they did was that they more or less suggested ways to resolve the situation, which was basically going through whatever constitutional means and mechanisms Iraq had. They suggested the prime minister step down, which happened, early elections, new electoral law, existing mechanisms that were definitely more reformist than revolutionary. And at the end of the day, I mean, we were talking earlier with various people about whether to be optimistic or pessimistic about Iraq, and this is where I go off script again. And you know, it's been 20 years since the 2003 war. Iraq is rife with corruption. Still not very great services in the country. Education is poor in the country. Longest government formation process in Iraq's history. At the same time, I think I derive a lot of optimism about Iraq's future from the fact that there are still democratic mechanisms that Iraqis tend to overlook and to not value despite them still occurring. The fact that we had a protest movement, which at the end of it, a prime minister stepped down, is a pretty big deal for a country that had a war in 2003, a sectarian war in 2006, another sectarian war in 2014. It's basically only had 5 years of actual stability. And the fact that a protest movement led to the resignation of a prime minister, early elections, a new electoral law, protest parties emerging from that movement to run in politics, gaining seats in parliament. And I can very easily tell you all the obstacles that these people face in the fight for inclusion and representation in Iraq. But at the same time, I try to have a balanced approach. And I actually have to because I am Iraqi. And if I don't believe that the state will survive without the need for a hugely destabilizing revolution, then I've just succumbed to more war and more instability, and I don't want to see the country go through that. But I also think there's a lot of unfair analysis tainted by the 2003 war, which is the sense that whatever happened in Iraq in 2003 was imposed by a foreign occupier, and so it's not organic, and therefore anything emerging from it is also impure and inorganic and doomed to fail. And I see this a lot from people with particular policy backgrounds, and I'll just, maybe I won't say from who exactly, but I hear this discourse a lot. And as the 2003 20th anniversary comes up, I'm hearing it more and more. And this desire to really distance oneself from Iraq, whether as an academic or a policy writer, has grown stronger because of this implication that if you write anything about Iraq or if you treat it as a normal country, then in a way you're saying that what happened in 2003 was okay and you're an apologist for the war. But I do think it's time we move on past this mentality because it's negatively impacting Iraqis, and Iraq hasn't, I mean, it's been poisoned by the 2003 war in many ways, but it hasn't. It's still surviving, and I don't think this kind of mentality really serves the country. So the point of optimism for me was that this did happen. We did have an early election. The early election did see new political parties. But going back to the story of the religious establishment and the civil society activists, they had a large role to play in this, of course, and I think that, I think that the reason that they shepherded the country towards this calm situation and supported the protesters and their demands, but also regulated the kinds of demands that got more attention than others, is because on one hand, they wanted to capture the goodwill of the people once they had lost it. Clerics all recognize that the mood in Iraq has changed, that you know they were revered in 2003, but they're no longer revered because of this association with politics that's tainted them. And I think they use this as an opportunity to recapture some of that lost popularity. They still have to do a lot more, but I think it's one step. But the other one is that what people tend to forget about the clerics in Iraq is that the most important thing to them is preserving the religious establishment itself, so the actual institution that they work in, their academic institution, where they teach, their offices, their seminaries, their students. It's a centuries-old institution. It means a lot to them, and they want to make sure it exists in a stable and secure environment. And for that reason, Iraq's stability is very important to them. And sometimes they make very tough decisions during times of authoritarianism and are willing to overlook state predation just to keep the religious establishment safe. So in light of this, they really did want to avoid revolution. They wanted to avoid civil war because they didn't want an environment of instability. And keep in mind, going to what I said earlier about them having lived under Saddam Hussein and that really being the formative years for them, that motivated them to pursue stability. And so I said I wanted to keep this very informal and non-academic, but I just wanted to bring up, I think, one interesting finding from my book project that I wanted to share, and I'll walk everyone through this. I collected the sermons of the two representatives that I told you about from 2017 up until the beginning of the pandemic. And I also collected the protest dates for various protests that occur in Iraq over that time. And I wanted to see how sermons differed during when they occurred on a Friday following a protest movement versus the one in which a protest movement didn't occur. So in other words, how much does their rhetoric change when there are protests? And what I found interesting is that they tend to, if you look at the far right, they tend to acknowledge, so that's a positive association with protest times, anything falling on that side. So they tend to acknowledge the grievances of people. They'll have words like anger, ignorance, emptiness, unemployment. It's an acknowledgement of grievances. At the same time, they'll also employ the language of institutions like protester, quota, peaceful, government, election, these mechanisms of stability. More interestingly than any of these is, I'm sure everyone is aware that there's this rhetoric of oppression within Shiaism that's so accessible. The entire story of Shiaism is built around a revolution. I mean, the way both Khomeini and Musa Sadr rallied people was through this language, and it's so easy to use it. And it was not only absent, but it was negatively correlated. Like, they specifically chose not to use it during protests. So this language of Shiaism, revolt, toppling. And that is because they do, for lack of a better word, have a status quo bias. They want stability, and so they'll avoid instigating events that will harm their institution or bring instability to the country. I animated these, but then I forgot to keep the animation when I said them. So all my conclusions are up there at once, but I'll go through them with you. So I think, yeah, these are the takeaways that, if you later on go and you're trying to remember what I was talking about this time, I would say to always remember that 2003 was a shock to the system for both clerics and for civil society. I talked about how it was a shock to the system for clerics. But for civil society in Iraq, which I spoke of less today, I'll give you a very quick background. So Iraq had, a very typical flourishing civil society prior to the Ba'athist era, doing pretty well in the region. And then when Ba'athism occurred and when Saddam Hussein particularly rose to power, it was all civil society was subsumed under the state. So organizations either became state and party organizations or they stopped existing. Some of them went underground, some of them went to Kurdistan after 1991 when it became autonomous at that time from the rest of Iraq. And for the most part though, it really was decimated in the Ba'athist era. And 2003 was a huge shock in the sense that there was a sudden influx of money from the US-led coalition to try to rebuild civil society in Iraq. And the thinking behind this was that civil society leads to democratization. So let's put money towards groups that work on human rights and democracy and like women's rights. And the huge influx of money led to a lot of corruption. Unsurprisingly, people created organizations just to get grants and then they disappeared and they became ghost organizations. So if you look at Iraq's NGO directorate, which registers every civil society organization, your first glimpse at it, you'll say, wow, 4,000 organizations registered in Iraq. Must be the most vibrant civil society scene in the region. When you go and you call them up, or try to call them up as I did, so many disconnected lines, so many ghost organizations, I don't think they'd be more than 500 in the whole country. That being said, I do think the civil society scene is vibrant. I just think it's it faces an uphill struggle in many ways, and it's really difficult to work with them because of this past of ghost organizations and this past issue with corruption and how it was dealt with in the media aftermath of 2003. One of the legacies of the war in that sense is that it was too fast in a sense, and it didn't really let them emerge in a more organic way. But alas, we still have a great civil society in Iraq. A handful of organizations are doing very important work. But like the clerics, this is all new for them. And you can see civil society is quite divided between the old generation of civil society that had gone underground or had gone to Iraqi Kurdistan, and the new generation, which is very much, grew up in the mid-2000s and had their foundational years under various sectarian wars and occupation and have different, to them the worst possible thing is having corruption, the worst possible thing is politicization of religion, whereas to this older generation, it's mainly they're communists. So different mindsets, but I think that's always an important thing to keep in mind. The religious establishment itself is very much in a period of adjustment. 20 years is a long time for an individual. It's a very short time for a centuries-old institution. This is the first time that they can really do interfaith outreach. And you know, now various UN organizations are looking to them in terms, particularly after what happened to minorities after ISIS, you know, looking to them to have a more of a leadership role in creating peace building in the country and in engaging in interfaith work. This is all really new to them, and they're learning how to do it. And as you know, in a very short time span, I've seen more and more clerics emerge that take on these responsibilities. But this wasn't something they had done before. And I think if you're thinking about what the future of religion looks like in Iraq, it's going to be a lot more of that public-facing cleric. And then clerics and activists have misaligned formative years. So I told you, clerics are always very, very much older than the Iraqi population. This has always been the case in Iraq because it takes 20 years to even reach a level where you become someone who can possibly be an emulated cleric. So you're already, I mean, I always compare it to doing a PhD and being in academia, but it's even longer than that. So there's always going to be a disparity between you and the population. And keep in mind, Iraqis are so young. I think most are born after 2003. So you're looking at an average age in the institution of being in your 50s and 60s and on the street being like in your early 20s. There's completely different mindsets here, and these are the activists and these are the clerics. And so naturally, there's going to be a misalignment there. But I think this disconnect doesn't even matter as much as the fact that as Iraqis grow more anxious about the state of their country, and as they protest more and they seek reform more, there's going to be a natural, they might be pitted against clerics in the sense that clerics will always want to preserve stability and activists might want to challenge the system a bit more. And so this might be a source of contention in the future. But what we have right now is this very strategic relationship that's based on the realization that they both want to manage their relationship with the state better and that they find allies in each other. And Shia clerics, at the end of the day, I started this presentation by telling you, they're independent of this, they consider themselves independent of the state because they have their own resources. There's an asterisk on this right now because they do get a lot of money from the endowments now and they get a lot of tax breaks. But the way they define themselves is a democratic institution. They always say, you know, people vote with their feet with us. They give us money, we're their representatives. Public opinion does matter to them, and they will try to appeal to the protesters. And at the same time, a lot of these upper middle class civil society activists recognize that the average Iraqi is actually pretty conservative and doesn't want to immediately jump into this very modern Iraq that has these values that are, you know, we're talking about adopted and imposed values, doesn't want to really impose something on a community unless it forms organically, and they need to have these kinds of partnerships and alliances with powerful actors who have reach within government in order to do this. And so I find this relationship between the two quite fascinating, but I didn't realize that these ties were being formed until I spoke to both sides and plainly told them I really don't understand what secular state you're after when you're willing to interact with clerics. But it's actually what civil society does best, and when we build bridges and partnerships across. So I hope this presented a view of so many actors in Iraq. I'm sorry if I missed anything by way of like explaining an institution or a subject. I'm much more eager for the Q&A than I ever am for the actual presentation, so I'm happy to answer any and all questions. Thank you so much.
Definitely interesting, and I really appreciate the way you break out of like the influence of religion in politics as either being ideological, like someone like some religious leaders get involved because they believe this is the right way to go, or like out of self-interest, they do this because they're allied with this or that political faction. said, and you bring the institutional aspect into it. There's an establishment that they're embedded in, and for any reason, it might not be in their financial interest, but they are inclined just naturally to preserve that institution. So I think like focusing on that variable, if I may borrow a political scientific term, is actually very crucial. But at the same time, and like rightly so, it introduces a lot of confusion, so to speak, in the analysis, because it all of a sudden opens up a lot of other possibilities that we might see on the ground. For instance, what kind of harm are we talking about when you're, for example, speaking about the religious leadership is wary of the harm that the protest or a revolution might cause the institution? They're not in like formal politics technically, so they're not like technically fully supported by the state, as you were saying. They see themselves as an independent institution. So what is the harm in like seeing the state at the worst case scenario toppled and changed? So at that institutional level, what are they wary of? Could it not be the opposite case, as it was in pre-revolutionary Iran, that the religious establishment actually gained a lot of support because they joined or left the opposition against the Shah? So like, what is that kind of like advantage, disadvantage, like cost benefit when we're talking at an institutional level? And like another sort of alleyway that this opens, this approach is, aren't they wary of the opposite outcome of like becoming too engaged in formal politics and then having what happened to Iranian Hausa happen to them, which is like complete state control, monitoring, just like bureaucratization, top down, and basically losing their control while they are like, they have it like a very safe cushion financially and politically, but losing the independence that they're so proud of. So yeah, just to kick off the discussion.
Just a small question. Oh no, they're really amazing questions. And as Maryam is asking them, I got really excited because they're all questions that I love to grapple with. So I'll go through them, but if I forget anything, please ask me. So when it comes to institutions as you know, as acting as one unit versus, you know, how ideology motivates or how strategic incentives motivate, in a lot of the political science literature, and a lot of it focuses on like the Catholic Church. Where we get a lot of theorizing about how clerics behave, there is a big sense of incentives, like monetary incentives or preservation of self rather than institution as an incentive in motivating clerics to participate in different ways. You know, there's a book about how the Catholic Church in Argentina was against protesters and turned against the revolution because they had such strong relations with the state. And they wanted to protect their interests, and that they weren't worried about people converting out of their faith group, which is different in other countries in Latin America. So I thought a lot about the ideological and the strategic incentives of individual clerics, and particularly as I worked on the larger book, which dealt with a lot of case studies. I mean, this is the very end of where my book is, and I recently started engaging with it because I didn't want to write a book about protests and revolution in Iraq without looking at, you know, the case that everyone is thinking about when they're looking at the country today. But if you look at the cases historically, what's really interesting is that you can find clerics who are on completely different sides of the ideological spectrum when it comes to how they perceive their relationship with the state, and who will still be motivated to protect the religious establishment because to them that is the most important thing above all. And I, you know, I started thinking about how people interact within their own institutions, and there is this sense of, I call it institutional responsibility, where it's not something that we study a lot or talk about when we talk about individual incentives for behaving in certain ways. But a lot of clerics with different ideologies, with different strategies, some of them at the expense of their own well-being, want to make sure that the religious establishment is preserved and perseveres and
and lives on. And I actually don't find this very surprising, because I actually think I'm not an economist, clearly, because I don't think humans are purely rational in a very, a very unidirectional way. But I do think that I can see different institutions, not just religious ones, for example, where their members care about the institution overall and work to preserve it. And I did see this across the years, across, you know, you have times in which they're allies with the state, like during this time period, and then you have times of like not terribly predatory, but you know, okay relationship with the state, and then times of completely predatory relationships or predatory behavior from the state. And despite these like completely different incentives for self-preservation, a lot of elite clerics, so it really depends on their positionality in the system, care about the preservation of the religious establishment. Which leads to your next question about, you know, why would they think that the protesters, if they became revolutionaries and created this new Iraq, why would it be bad for the religious establishment? It's nothing about the protesters themselves. They could, you know, they could be shaking hands and having dinners with these protesters every day before this revolution takes off, and they still would not believe in revolution being quick and easy. I think they're just very pragmatic, and I think that has a large part to do with them having lived under authoritarianism and seen unsuccessful revolutions in the past. So in many ways, they have a very strong political science like view of what a revolution looks like and the cost of a revolution. So they don't have the belief that it will actually be a smooth process. So it's less about the ideals of a revolution and less about the people leading it and whether they believe in them or not, as much as they know that in Iraq, a country that's seen two civil wars in the last two decades and various other wars before that, revolution isn't going to be quick and painless. And I think really that's what motivates them. I think I missed the third question.
I don't think I had numbered questions. It was just a general thing.
Oh, about the predation, or about the, how are they not worried about the state?
Yes,
would.
State control. Yeah.
Okay, so it's funny that you bring up Iran, because I always ask clerics, like, are you, you know, your students complain that they can't get a job teaching at a university, even though they've spent 30 years studying, because you don't have a certificate to give them, because no one recognizes, like, no one recognizes that a Grand Ayatollah says this guy is, you know, very informed and has this knowledge of Islam, so why aren't you thinking about having an alternate institution that can provide certificates? And they told me plainly, you know, our worst fear is to be like Al-Azhar or to be like Qom, where it becomes so institutionalized that the state can actually come in and make decisions for us. So they would rather be selective about, you know, self-selection is what happens. If you self-select into the system, you know you're not getting a certificate out of it. You know that you can be as educated as a PhD holder in Iraq, but or more, and you won't be recognized officially as this. And it's, I think they're keeping this, they want to keep this because it's part of what keeps the state away. So they're very, very wary of it.
But then, conceding to be affiliated with an Islamic or Islamist party would not amount to that level of...
They've never conceded, though. That's the thing. They always push against it. It's Islamist parties who are like, oh, we trace our roots to the religious establishment. Oh, there's a photo of me sitting next to a cleric or doing this or that.
They never officially give in.
I think there was a brief moment in the mid-2000s where it seemed like they were pushing for a particular party, but I think the lesson has been learned that the cost of that is not worth it and needless, essentially, because they do enjoy a very good position when it comes to the state. I mean, Grand Ayatollah Sistani actually gets to appoint the head of the Shia religious endowment, so he gets to appoint someone within the state. It's a very strong position.
If I might usurp my privileges, the moderator, for just two more minutes, and then open it to the audience. Thank you for all this. This makes it so much more interesting to learn. I think an elephant in the presentation was the influence of Iran. You did mention it, but how much is the behavior of the clerical Shia establishment in Iraq affected by Iranian support or disagreements with Iran, like the recent like factionalism and but was it during the Tashrin movement as well that people were chanting against Iranian influence, right?
Yes.
So yeah, where does Iran?
Such a tough question. I joke that I have an Iraq bingo sheet for every presentation I do, and Iranian influence is always, you know, the one of the cores there, and you very smartly noticed that I kept it out of the presentation. It's because it's a conversation that truly never ends. There's so many layers to it. I think one of the layers, I mean, yes, so during the protest movement, there was a very strong anti-Iranian sentiment. There were not just shouts against Iran, but there was also the burning of Iranian consulates in Karbala and in Najaf, which is astounding because these are like the centers of Shiism. And so from a public sense, there is a very strong anti-Iranian sentiment. And to me, genuinely, and we saw this again, by the way, during the Gulf Cup, because Iran made a big fuss about how dare the Arabs call it the Arabian Gulf Cup when it should be called the Persian Gulf Cup. And it made everyone in Iraq very angry, including some people who actually, you know, were quite friendly towards Iran. So it was very bad PR. For Iran in Iraq, but it made me realize, you know, in Iraq on the street, how very easily the same racism that Saddam Hussein used to deport people in the 80s, how the same racism that he built an entire war around can be so easily activated by any enterprising, you know, political elite. And obviously, no average citizen separates an entire country from. Separates it into its, you know, its leadership and its population and all these things that people tend to generalize and stereotype in the heights of passion and particularly nationalist passion. But I think one thing that we never talk about in when it comes to Iraq is that this is actually something that this anti-Iranian intervention sentiment goes so easily with this anti-Iranian racism that you can see in Iraq that can actually, that really does remind me of the Ba'athist era in very terrible ways. I mean, and the reason I bring this up is because when I was working on Najaf and working on the religious establishment in Najaf, and I told this to Maryam earlier, one of the things I did is I went through these biographical dictionaries of clerics from like 1900 till like very recently to see like, what does Najaf look like? Who are the people who live here and study here? And, you know, I tried to divide them by nationality, like how many Iraqis are in Najaf, because there's this big sentiment, and it's true that Najaf actually had a lot more Iranian clerics, or clerics of Iranian origin, up until 1960s with Mohsen al-Hakim being very insistent on making more Iraqi clerics present, and so like Arab Iraqi clerics present. And at some point, it like the sense of national identity and ethnic identity became so muddled in that city. I honestly couldn't code anymore who is Iranian and who is Iraqi, because if someone is born in Najaf and lived in Najaf their entire life, but their family had immigrated from, you know, from Qom or something, like what do you code this person as versus an Arab who like studied in Najaf and then went and studied in Iran and then stayed the rest of their life there. And it's something about that city. It's not like any other city in Iraq. The identity is so fluid in it that racism getting out of hand in that city could be something that's very terrible for Iraq. And that's really where the sense of, you know, these things happening during the protest movement were one thing in Baghdad and like Basra and all these places that had didn't have Najaf's identity, but when it came to Najaf, I think it was completely different. And I think this fluid identity still exists today. If you go to Najaf, there isn't like, I mean, Sistani himself is, as they say, Iranian and doesn't even have an Iraqi passport. So, and yet he is like the most powerful person in Iraq, and he's not a source of Iranian political intervention in Iraq. So it really defies easy description, I would say.